Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Joining us now is an author of a book coming out on Christmas Day, December 25th, how appropriate. It's called The Cult of Christianity. The author is John Verner. Thank you for taking time to talk about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
I want to first address this in the sense of Cult of Christianity, how churches control, contain, and convert. That's going to be a pretty controversial title, and releasing it on the holiday of Christ, right? So, what made you go this way and on that day?
Right. So, I grew up as a cult, it was probably actually a fairly typical experience for an evangelical in the U.S. I had a pretty good family. Like, there wasn't anything that would probably strike as particularly traumatic about it. But as I grew up in it and started taking ownership of the faith later on, I decided to pursue a degree in pastoral ministry. And I did such. I had my Bachelor's of Arts in Biblical Exposition from Moody Bible Institute. And the further I went into the rabbit hole, so to speak, I kept noticing that what I really feared about Christianity was true. And that's that it was a lot more about preserving power for people who had obtained it. Kind of fast forwarding to why I'm now releasing it on Christmas Day. One, December 25th is not significant in any kind of historical understanding of Christianity. And there's a lot of traditions borrowed from pagan cultures. And my own personal attitude has always been a little bit of a stick it to the man kind of guy. So I figured, hey, December 25th seems like a good day to release a book dismantling something a lot of people care about.
So what is it that they taught you when you were going to ministerial school that brought you to these conclusions?
So it's interesting, right? Because a lot of what I was explicitly taught was at least packaged as as ways to do ministry. And the ways to do ministry, you would think, would involve a lot of practical admin stuff. It would involve helping less fortunate people. But really what they talk about more than anything is crowd control. And at first, when you first hear it, it might not sound that way. But when you actually sit back and reflect on what they're talking about, that's what it is. So, for example, I did a pastoral internship at one church, and me and the other pastoral intern came up with this idea to help local homeless people by bringing the church together and making little kits that would have stuff like socks, you know, protein bars, those kind of things, and we could just distribute them because I was in Spokane, Washington at the time, and Spokane, Washington has a huge homelessness crisis, to be honest. And so we were like, this is a way we can help our community, get the church involved, all of this. And at first, the leadership of that church was way on board. But then towards the end of that experience, they started going, you know, we just don't know what kind of size socks we need. We should just cancel the whole thing. And it was really odd, but what I realized was happening was me and the other pastoral intern were honestly starting to threaten the control of that particular pastor. And we had no ill intentions, but our structure is really, really important to churches, and they will preserve it at almost any cost.
So is this something that winds up getting into the curriculum when you're trained to be a pastor, that you know, you have to build a flock and then you protect it from any other pastor coming in? Is it really about sort of almost building a company as in having a set of customers rather than it is sharing the good word?
Well, that's a great question, because I do have a chapter towards the end of my book where I talk about multi-level marketing. And there certainly is a parallel. It's just instead of a you know, gimmicky knife, the product is salvation. There is definitely an encouragement, and I am being very specific here with evangelicalism. I say Christianity because it matches the alliteration better. But like, I'm specifically talking about evangelicals who put an emphasis on conversion. And yeah, I would say while they try to refrain from explicitly saying, keep other pastors away and stuff, there's a certain vibe you can tell when it's like, you gotta watch out for wolves in sheep's clothing. But if you actually dig into what they mean by that, they're talking about people with ideas. A lot of the theme of what I talk about in the book is just how closed-mindedness is what their goal is, because the second that their flock start to open their minds, that's when they start losing their control and containment.
So let me ask you, when you watch some of these televangelists on TV, like Jim Baker or maybe going back a few years, Ted Haggard or Swagger, what goes through your mind when how they try to raise money and I guess what you might call it, manipulate people?
Yeah. Well, when I watch Jim Baker, I think that food looks disgusting. Yeah, so they're kind of like exaggerated forms of what I think happens on a smaller scale throughout the country when I see televangelists. Because if you went to, you know, the church down the road and started talking to the pastor about televangelists, they would quickly condemn them as well. There wouldn't be much of an argument. You're like, yeah, those guys are crazy.
Example, just last week on the Jim Baker show, they had a guest on who was praising Donald Trump because Trump is creating a space force that will protect us from the apocalyptic asteroid that was prophesied in the Bible to come and blow us up. Which is, you know, crazy stuff, but I mean, it's on TV and people see this as, you know, here's somebody that people are calling and giving their money to.
I mean, part of what I believe personally is just a lot of TV is garbage. I don't know how half the stuff like gets on there. So I don't know, but I have known people who have subscribed to people, people who believe equally as crazy things on a more local level. What I think is cult leaders in general, what they're doing is they're exploiting real human needs. And one real human need that I believe all humans have is this sense of needing a sense of belonging and needing a sense of understanding. And cult leaders can kind of take ownership and weaponize what they call truth. And so I don't know the televangelist scale. Again, it's kind of too mind-boggling to even dissect. But on a local scale where, you know, you do have the pastor who's, you know, having an affair with the secretary, but, like, no one says boo about it, I think the reason those things can happen is they're like, yeah, but that's our truth guy. That's the guy who, if we don't have him, where will we go? How will we think? And it's really just this dependence on a leader to function. I mean, life is tough, and sometimes the simplest solution says, I'll just do whatever that guy tells me.
Yeah, I mean, people do tend to take cues. It does sort of shock me, though, that it seems like the opposite of a lot of things in life, where, yes, TV is crazy, but you would figure that the biggest churches with the TV stations would present the more watered-down versions of the religion, the more sane stuff, maybe somewhat like Joel Osteen.
Mm-hmm.
But typically what it's been for the last few decades is the most radicalized and weirdest stuff makes it onto TV. So when I see your book title, I say, he must be talking about the televangelists, because these are people who really look like cult leaders.
Yeah, they certainly do. I mean, and actually what I try to focus on in my book is that's the obvious guy, right? We can all kind of point and laugh. What's less obvious is your pastor next door, who seems like a nice guy. And, like, you've seen him, you know, help jumpstart someone's car, so you think he's a hero. And what I tend to focus on is, and what, frankly, scares me more is with my vast experience in different churches, like, realizing that the structure itself lends itself to cult leaders arising and cult followers being brainwashed. One more point on the televangelist thing, as far as like a contrast between someone like Joel Osteen and other people such as Mark Driscoll, and like these kind of like minor characters that maybe not everyone's heard about. And then you have someone like Jim Baker, who's everyone's heard about because he's kind of ridiculous. What's interesting about the sort of minor televangelist dynamic or minor mini celebrity pastor idea is those guys do get to power because, authority is typically given, right? Not forced. And I think people give these guys authority because they're passionate and they speak to a need. And a lot of what I learned in my pastoral training was it's about raising needs. I can't tell you how many hours we talked about that. Find the needs of your congregation and raise them and let them know you're aware of them. And I think that makes a lot of people feel seen and heard. And they gravitate towards feeling seen and heard in a world that increasingly you don't feel seen or heard. Everybody's looking at their phone and caring about their day. So when a guy gets up on stage and says, I know you're lonely, you gravitate towards them.
Yeah, but this is all in how you do it, right? I mean, knowing what somebody else's needs are can just be normal empathy and sympathy.
It could be.
and you can do it in other ways where it's clearly different. So, for example, I remember I got pulled into, when I was much younger, one of the Scientology buildings.
Mm, yeah.
They said, we want you to come and, take our little test and talk to our person. I said, okay. I was 18. I didn't know what it was. And they said, so what is it you're looking for in life? And I think I said something along the lines of, I want to, date more girls or something like that. Which, when you're an 18-year-old fella, that's, your number one need. Yeah. But then it became very quickly. They said, well, you need to buy this book and this book and this book. Then you need to give us this and then come to our meeting. And
And I said, well, I'm not buying any books. I don't read. I'm 18. And they said, well, you know, how are you going to meet girls if you don't buy her book? So it became immediately, you know, apparent that they were going to take whatever I said to them as a need and use that to exploit to get what they wanted.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's something I was it's hard now because it wasn't to me that long ago. But there was a time where I'll tell a little anecdote. There was a preaching competition at the school I went to, which is a mind-boggling concept. But all the people in my particular major had to compete to see who could preach the best.
Is that like one of those rap competitions kind of?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. Yeah, that would have been fun if there was a beat behind it. I can't believe. Yeah, I mean, the poor judges have to listen to these hour-long lectures back to back to back from these, you know, 22-year-olds. My gosh, what a horrible thing. But I did end up winning, and so part of the reward for winning was you got to speak in chapel, which was mandatory for people to go, you know, 3 times a week or whatever. And so people were forced to listen to me, and I gave a sermon, and you know, it was decent sermon. It wasn't too bad, but a lot of what I did was that raising of needs. I talked about loneliness because I knew my school and I knew people felt very lonely at my school, like they didn't have people they could confide in. And afterwards, people were asking me the craziest life advice questions. They were asking, well, you know, I don't know what I should do after college. Like, do you have any career advice? I'm like, I'm 22, and I just gave a sermon about loneliness, and now you automatically think I'm qualified to give you advice. So I think by its very nature, you just see someone speaking, and you gravitate towards that person. We do it with celebrities all the time. The biggest problem in Christianity is all the while these things are going on, people are actually have needs that the churches could meet, and they're not. And they pretend to and get tax write-offs. I mean, there's a lot of heinous things going on behind closed doors.
So let me ask you, talking about who becomes a preacher, you know, so I'm in political science. I study politicians and what they do and why they do it. And, you know, politicians are different than other people. They have a need to be recognized. They want to, you know, be up in front of people, and they want power and control over other people. Are these things that you find in people who become preachers? Is the whole setup of it designed just so that, you know, it's appealing to those folks, and then the ones who are best at controlling others are the ones who are going to rise to the top?
Well, I definitely think in regards to wanting to be recognized, that's why I'm an author.
That's why I'm a professor too.
Right. Yeah, for sure.
Everybody has it to some degree, but I think there's a difference in, you know, you and I write books and we sell books, but that's a voluntary thing. You know, someone will buy it and read it or not. Whereas, you know, if you want to be a politician or a preacher, it's more you want to have more direct control over someone.
Yeah, I think there's a lot going on. I mean, I can speak for me personally that I felt a calling, as they say. And that's the conditioning of evangelicalism is they talk about calling in this vague way and don't ever really define what it is, how it happens. Or anything like that. It's like an internal voice that tells you you're supposed to be a pastor. And of course, they'll reference it as God eventually. But they take a long time to get there. And the reason for that, in my belief, is the people who seek to be pastors probably didn't choose it themselves very much. What probably happened is they were in their own little church. Well, there's two scenarios that typically happen. One is they grew up in church, and they were the good one, and there were probably a lot of people who started talking to their church leaders, as you're conditioned to do, about being future leadership. And the ones that that the church is like, I don't know, this guy might change too many things, they'll kind of talk him down. And the guy who kind of is a conformist, they'll talk him up and say, yeah, you should pursue this. In my case, when I decided to pursue pastoral ministry, it was not welcomed by my church. And part of it was because they had known in high school all the different issues I had had with them. The first chapter in my book opens with a story of what I call spiritual abuse, and it was really the first time I understood that churches cared a lot about their power. And so there's, as far as who ends up going into it, I think it really depends on the conditioning they've received from their leaders. The second type of person is someone who, like, got off drugs because of some program and now thinks they gotta become a pastor. That's the second type of person who just wants to have a complete 180 life change, and pastor is the opposite of many other types of lives.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess if you watch this as an evolutionary process where you have, you know, churches pop up with the pastor and then other pastors come in, I mean, you would think over time that the ones who are best at pulling in people and keeping them there are going to be the ones who are the most successful. And those aren't necessarily people who are giving a good message, right? I mean, there's a different right. set of skills for the marketing and bringing the people back. Let me ask you about, so there's a preacher I've been watching on YouTube, and okay. I'm surprised they haven't removed him yet, but he's from Arizona, and it's a real wackadoo church. I'll look up his name in a moment, but he's against fluoride in the water. And
oh, nice.
And he says a really lot of awful things about gay people and and whatnot. Are those cults? These sorts of things? Are those more culty than the cults that you're concerned with?
So maybe what would help is some of my terms, why I've settled on cults. You know, there were other titles I thought about, like country club church and like stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, that's not quite hitting what I mean. And the reason I named my book The Cult of Christianity is what I saw was this clear distinction between leaders and followers. So it's not necessarily the content as horrible as a church like Westboro is, you know, that has a name I can't say, for their website. Those are more heinous, evil. I mean, I'm comfortable saying this, heinous, evil people. But it's the cult structure, we see it more negatively that way, but it probably exists in more subtle ways too. So while I do spend time talking in my book about LGBTQIA plus issues, I think that's kind of a symptom of the cult structure rather than necessarily the meat of the content.
Okay. What do you think can be done about any of this? I mean, we do see some extreme stuff, but you seem to be pointing out that some of these techniques are being used at your run-of-the-mill local church here.
Yeah.
What can be done and what should be done?
It sounds easier than it is. Be open-minded. you would be amazed at how many Christians I've talked to who have said they're open-minded. And then when I tell them my best friend is trans, they want to get out of the conversation as soon as possible. And it's based on this subtext of the word sin that's been used pretty horrifically in churches. What churches will typically do is they'll say all sin is equal. I've studied the Bible in the original language. I can tell you it's nowhere in there. Nowhere does it say all sin is equal. There's like one passage that kind of implies all sin is equally forgiven. But there's nothing that says all sin is equal. And in fact, in Hebrew, the idea of sin is missing the mark or off the path. But that implies you can miss the mark or be off the path by quite a bit or by a little bit. But evangelicals typically treat all sin as the same, or at least they preach they treat all sin as the same. And the reason for that is so that when a church leader messes up when they sin, they can say, well, Jesus forgives them, that's okay. But when a congregate sins, whether they do or not, usually it has to do with challenging authority or failure to submit to authority. I have a lot of stories about that in my book. When they fail to do that, they can condemn it. So that's why they kind of make sin this big thing. And that's why you see them, it kind of blows your mind if you're on the outside and you see someone treat someone of a different sexual orientation so terribly, when you know people in that church are probably cheating on their wives and there's, like, you know, porn addictions. And I mean, 50% of pastors are willing to admit they're addicted to porn. That doesn't even count the ones that aren't willing to admit it. And yet they're mad at, like, you know, people of different sexual orientation. It is truly mind-boggling, but the reason that those inconsistencies happen is because there's an effort to preserve church leaders and subjugate church followers.
Sort of funny you bring up the porn, because there's a debate brewing, particularly on the Christian right now. It seems they want to do a push for a national porn ban online. But it strikes me as funny that you have a lot of the preachers who are watching the porn all the time.
All those efforts, it's silly. I mean, like, you know, there's a million issues you can point to. Look at abortion, where, like, no matter where you fall on the issue, you will see if a pastor slept with a secretary and she got pregnant, I have a feeling an abortion would be okay all of a sudden. They do that with issues all the time, and it's just about public image. It's not substantive at all.
So I guess what this gets me thinking about is if there isn't that much we can do, I mean, do we need to call out these pastors more? I mean, it seems like many of them are hypocrites.
Yeah,
the person who comes to my mind immediately is Ted Haggard, who was against, you know, gay people, and then it turned out he was engaging in a gay tryst with a lot of crystal meth involved.
What a party!
Yeah.
So there's a couple of suggestions I have sprinkled throughout. Again, I'm only 25 right now. I don't know anything. I don't know how to solve any world problems, but my guess would, I make one argument in my book to just stop paying pastors, just stop paying them. Because what I've noticed is pastors don't work that hard. they portray themselves as working really hard, and they really don't. They do some hard, emotionally draining stuff. I mean, I give all my disclaimers throughout my book. There are people who really do put in the time, put in the work, and, like, care about people. And some of those people are in those positions, and that was their motivation, and they're good people, and I don't want them to feel shamed in any kind of way. The problem is, if God's called you to...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Do this. And I'm doing air quotes, called you to this sacrificial ministry, then actually sacrifice and don't take a paycheck. Because it seems to me like there's certainly no biblical evidence that pastors should be paid. The office of pastor doesn't even exist in the Bible. There's all these crazy things that we've just all kind of accepted because it's fit into a Western business model. And what's so dangerous about it is you're exploiting real human, and I'm comfortable saying real spiritual needs of humans, for your own gain. So one thing you can do is, I say even cut your pastor's paycheck in half and see if they stick around. And my guess is their call to, preach at that church will change into a call to leave that church.
I agree with you, but I have to wonder, I mean, if it's a full-time job.
It's not.
Okay. So
that's, I mean, that's important
point here. Is it they show up on the weekend, they give a speech, and maybe they take a few phone calls, and you're saying they could probably have a full-time job on top of doing that.
I've observed a lot of different pastors. I've worked with a lot of different pastors, and then I've interned and been a youth pastor myself. You can do about 20 hours of work, like real qualified work. The thing is, you're kind of always on call. At least that's the myth. Is that like you're always there for your congregation? I would say for some pastors that might be true, but for most it's not. Most pastors will be like, I need to be with my family because family comes first, and then everyone backs off. And they've kind of found a loophole where they really don't have to work that hard. Now, work is work. I mean, like, when I say don't pay them, I'm only saying don't pay them because they claim to be sacrificial leaders. If they were like, no, we're business people and this is all to make us feel better, and they were authentic and everybody knew what was going on, it'd be fine. The problem is you exploit vulnerable people, and then there's honestly like so many cultures and churches where they go, man, our pastor works so hard and he never requires any thanks. And I'm like, yeah, he does. That's what the offering plate is for. It's really sad because there's a lot of potential for good in churches. I think that's why part of my motivation in writing it is I don't think these are just empty buildings where nothing could get done ever because it's so toxic. I'm like, no, if you just adjust a few things, this really could be a force for good. But as long as the cult mentality of leaders and followers exists, it's never going to happen.
Yeah, so that sort of leaves us in a strange place. So how many churches are out there that you think engage in this sort of thing? Hundreds, thousands?
I can't remember the numbers right off my head, but one thing I know is there's somewhere around 300,000 churches in the U.S., I believe, that are, you know, Christian churches. So that's still excluding like Mormons and stuff, which is fun because Mormons would be like, why are you excluding us? There's a lot of churches. I would say it's the very power structure by nature lends itself to it. So my guess would be all churches have for some period of time, but we can probably allow a little grace for that and say, okay, human nature isn't always good. You're going to engage in some bad stuff every now and then. But if I want to say like establishment, consistently like that, my guess would be well over 80% of churches in the U.S. Are basically this kind of cult.
And what sort of effect can that have on the flock? So what's the typical thing that would happen to a person? Maybe not the worst case scenario, but what's sort of the medium case bad scenario?
I say happy holidays and you feel like I'm persecuting you. I mean, like, it's a silly example, but it's pretty indicative of what happens a lot. Is there's an us versus them mentality that's been beaten into your head.
And this is the pastors that do it, that they teach the people that if someone says happy holidays, that they're trying to destroy your faith and you need to see them as an outsider.
Yeah, so that particular example comes from like a 1945, John Birch Society that they like, they said like, oh, like there's a communist plot to take the Christ out of Christmas, and it's stuck today. Newt Gingrich, when he was running in 2012, was asked how his faith would relate to its presidency, and he said, there's a war on Christians. And that's scary, because if a president's like willing to pit citizen against citizen and say there's a war against Christians when, you know, in God we trust, I'm pretty sure is still on the dollar bill. It's truly frightening.
Jim Baker actually brought this up on his show maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they said that only a few years ago it was illegal to say Merry Christmas, but now Donald Trump has made it safe again, so you won't get arrested.
I can go into politics a little bit. So first off, shout out to my Yang gang. I'm all for Andrew Yang. I had to just say that. But what's interesting with Donald Trump is he won the evangelical vote, which is a huge vote because white evangelicals cover around 30% of the U.S. population. So, I mean, pretty substantial chunk. So if you win a group that's easy to manipulate and force them to think monolithically, he won that vote. And what's crazy is white evangelicals were polled on like why they voted for Trump. And when I saw this, I went, okay, so it's abortion, right? Like that's why they voted for him. They thought somehow he'd reverse Roe v. Wade or something. And when I clicked on it, their number one concern was the economy. And they thought Trump would fix the economy. And what I find interesting about that is evangelicals like to talk the talk about like being for the poor, being for the oppressed and stuff. I've never met a group of people more concerned about money. They're constantly worried about it. And I think it's one led by example among the cult leaders and churches. They clearly care about money. And then I think secondarily, they don't just see it, but they typically are pretty privileged people in evangelical churches. They, you know, go to church on Sunday. They will go to their 9-to-5. They put their, you know, kids in a few sports programs, and that's their life, and they've settled into it, and it's comfortable, all the while not realizing that these cult leaders are manipulating them for ulterior agendas.
Yeah, you can go to YouTube and you can put in like crazy preachers and whatnot. You can find all sorts of egregious behavior by some of these people. And that doesn't shock me that much.
Right.
What does shock me is that when you look into some of these and then you'll hear like an interview with some of the people in the church, they'll be like, oh, well, that's okay. You know, so there's one pastor that I see, I think in North Carolina, where he said, if you think your son is gay, you should snap his wrist.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one, yeah.
Yeah, and then he also said that, you know, he was at a youth summer camp, and he thought one of the students wasn't taking...
Oh, he punches him in the face?
Yeah, he wasn't taking... Yeah. He said, you're not taking the Lord serious, so I punched him in the face.
Oh, my gosh. That's actually one of my favorite. It's unbelievable, and, like, I think you hear someone in the background go, amen, and you're like, what?
And then people tend to think there's violence against either family members or other people is somehow okay. But
yeah.
I can't imagine anyone getting away with saying such things if they weren't in front of a church.
Ooh, I have a story that hopefully won't get me sued. This is really the beginning of my book, so this ties in well. When I was 16, I was going to this church, and I will keep it as vague as I can so no one sues me. The teenagers at that church were not respected very well. part of it was I was in a punk rock band with my best friend who went to that church as well. So we, you know, had like long hair, wore skinny jeans, and this particular church was just not into that vibe. And so we were constantly like given a harder time than most. And, you know, we're teenagers, so when we're given a hard time, we're going to give it, you know, back twice as hard, right? So we would come in late to church, which is really not that big a deal. But to some people, that was the most atrocious thing ever, because we were, my guess is it was breaking the order and breaking the control. And so what they would do is when it was church time, they'd flick the lights, you know, on and off, like, come on, it's time. And so me and the other teenagers, we were, you know, in a circle talking, and we saw it and kind of rolled our eyes and kept talking. And then the guy does it again. He flips the lights over and over, and he's like, come on in. And then we're like, we'll be in a second. And then he yelled at me in that way that only your dad can yell at you, you know, where he was just like, John. But yeah, very, very deep voice. He's like, come in now. And I'm very concerned. So I go up. Everyone else went into the church, and so I tried to start talking to him. And I'm a speaker, so I have big gestures. So my gestures are pretty big. I'm like, hey, hey, hey. And he's like, you don't get to talk to me. You don't get to talk to me. You're too young. You're too young. You don't get to talk to me. And he slapped my hand out of the way. And it was mind-blowing. And that's actually what started, I don't mention all those details in the book, but that's what started my inspiration to write a letter to those church leaders. And when I wrote that letter and I emailed it to the pastor, I ended up having a meeting where I really started hearing the most ridiculous things I think I've ever heard in my life. And that's kind of what started me on this path of I need to be critical of the church leaders around me.
So they would not accept any criticism for their behavior?
Oh, not at all. Quite the opposite. So when I wrote my letter to criticize them, I kind of broke it down into certain categories. Like I was like, so you're disrespectful for youth. We've tried to volunteer to help with music and you've said, no, we don't trust you. And then like I was using Bible references the whole time. Like I was very confused. In fact, there's one Bible verse that, says, let no one despise you for your youth. Pretty plain English. And by the time plain Greek, but eventually English. And so when I got into the room with them, there were three elders there and me, they gaslighted me and basically said that verse means you shouldn't be worthy of despise. Yeah, and it was eye-opening. They called my long hair sinful because I was trying to look like the world. They said I shouldn't hug girls so much. There was a lot of content in that meeting that was clearly them just kind of throwing a fit at a 16-year-old who saw problems in their community.
So what's going on with church membership? I mean, I seem to see the trend that it's going down. Does that seem to be the case? Are people catching on to this and sort of moving on?
So the biggest problem is in any market, you have to get young people to stick around or else your market fails, right? Because that's the next generation or whatever. So I'm on the cutoff, the cusp of the cutoff of a millennial. And millennials do not like church. They're over church. The stories I have are not that dissimilar from a lot of them, and we're kind of, we, you know, grew up with the internet. We have more quick access to a lot of other people's stories. So I think, yeah, the trend is downward, but churches are hard at work trying to figure out how to keep young people around and are making some very interesting compromises in order to try to maintain their power still. They're rebranding, they're naming their churches all these trendy names. They got the rock music going. They're really, really trying. So I don't know. We'll see what happens with Gen Z and how they interpret church because less of them were forced into it. So there might be this weird kind of dynamic where they didn't grow up with negative connotations, so they might gravitate towards it more. But it's really hard to tell. But yeah, overall, church attendance is going down. But people are still happy to identify with churches without much hesitation. You ask the 10 people on the street, are you a Christian? Like, over half of them will say yeah. And that is part of the culture in the U.S.
And what about sort of the more cult-driven outfits? Like, I keep hearing about these sort of end times Christian groups that are growing where they're, you know, saying the end is near, Trump is part of it.
Yeah, well, there's that separate, book, The Cult of Trump, there are Trump is fascinating on many levels, but the reason I think evangelicals have gravitated towards him and people like him who just kind of have this you can't mess with me mentality is because they've been fed this myth of oppression for a long time, that they're the ones who are oppressed, they're being persecuted. There's a great book called The Myth of Persecution by, I think her name's Candace. She's a professor, Candace maybe? She's a professor over at Notre Dame and one of the leaders in ancient church history. And she really breaks down how there were all these manufactured stories of martyrs and stuff, and how Christians kind of took early anti-Semitism and kind of coaxed it in their own stench, so to speak, and said people hated us. You know, it wasn't Jews, it was Christians. Christians were persecuted. Christians were persecuted. Christians are persecuted. They want to take the Christ out of Christmas, you know. There's a guy, I forget his name, but he owned Masterpiece Cake Shop. And then there was a homosexual couple that wanted him to do their wedding cake. And he refused, and it blew up into this whole thing where they sued him, and then he countersued. And people were like, see, the church is still being persecuted. Mm-hmm. And it was like, no, that's not what happened. A guy refused to bake people cakes, and then there were lawsuits. That's all that happened. No one was being, like, you know, put on a stake and burned. and so I think the reason someone like that people gravitate towards the more violent guys is it feels like a leader who can, like, protect you from this supposed oppression that you're under. And that's why they gravitate towards them. I think that's one possible reason, at least.
All right. So what's next? So we've got the first book. It comes out on Christmas.
Correct.
Do you have the follow-up coming out on Easter?
Every Christian holiday, I'm just going to try to get more and more people angry. That's my goal. No, I have a lot of stuff in the works. I do kind of want to, I've been married and I'm now divorced. It was quite quick. And I am interested in writing about that. I do hint at it in this book, how specifically, churches, manipulate young people into, this horrible purity culture where, you're not allowed to have sex until you're married and then don't talk about it with anyone but God.
Was that a problem in your marriage? I don't want to pry too deeply. Yeah.
No, absolutely it was. There was shame on both ends. She grew up Christian as well. Both explicitly and implicitly, there was a lot of shame and intimacy issues due to that. And beyond that, probably an even worse problem, because, you know, those things can be worked out over time. The bigger issue was I felt that like such a failure in different ways that that I felt like my responsibility was to, like, fix my life with God before it was fix my life with my spouse. I mean, I remember, like, knowing I had issues I needed to talk about with my wife, but I'd go take a shower and pray about it. And that is conditioning. There's no reason why that would be a good idea, to flock to, the guy in the sky instead of the girl right next to you. It's truly upsetting, and I see it all the time. Divorce rates inside of church, are no different than outside. It's still hovers around 50%. And yeah, it's pretty tragic. And I'll go further.
I want to touch on that just for a moment. Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lot of shame around sex in some of these churches. And it seems to me that, you know, having seen some of these folks, you're like, I'm saving myself for marriage, and then they're 30.
Yeah.
And they haven't been with anyone yet, and then they get married. I mean, is it just the case that these are people who don't really want to have sex?
Yeah, that's a whole other thing, right? Because if I went to a church and said, I think I might be asexual, that would be like, well, is that gay? Because you can't be that, you know? I mean, like, the lack of education around sex in churches, I mean, I don't even know how high up it goes. I don't know if, you know, pastors even know how to have sex half the time. Like, it's a very fascinating dynamic where... and an anti-biblical one at that. I mean, you know, the Bible's pretty clear that you're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. I mean, like, I don't know. There's a lot at play with that issue, which is why it might take another book to tackle. but yeah, no, purity culture has been dissected before. And what's really upsetting, I would say it primarily affects young Christian women who are told that their responsibility is to bridle the lust of men. Like, that's why there's these crazy dress codes in private Christian schools where girls can't show their shoulders. Like, the attitude is women have a responsibility to keep us horny boys under control. And it's honestly terrible, because they grow up their whole lives thinking that, and then, yeah, you get married and you're told, okay, now have at it, and you're like, but I've been conditioned to think this is gross. I've been conditioned to think this is terrible. I've been conditioned to think this might send me to hell. And it's horrible.
So just getting married doesn't sort of change that.
No, I mean, it's a document. And what's funny is, I mean, like, what ends up happening, it certainly happened with me, and I know it's happened with others, is you do everything but sex. I mean, that's your solution to the problem, and that's what...
Married, but then after getting married, it doesn't change
right.
the view. It's like, well, I've waited all my life because the church says now that I'm married, it's okay to get on with it. But somehow they still feel shame and guilt, even though... this is supposed to be when you're supposed to have sex.
Yeah, I mean, shame is, like, probably the best weapon at a cult leader's disposal. I mean, it's effective, it works, it contains your followers to your control. It's used in various ways, honestly, with sex, with a bunch of other things. And it really is crazy. I mean, I talk about in my book how, like, consent from a church leader is more important than consent from you when it comes to sex, because when you're a young couple, you will be interviewed by your church leaders at some point, either formally or informally. They will say, hey, so what are your intentions? And they'll just straight up ask you, are you having sex? I mean, like, they want to be involved in that intimate part of your life. And when you're 21, that's an inappropriate dynamic half the time, especially when some of these church leaders are 60, 70 years old and they're prying into your sex life. It's uncomfortable, and it borders on abuse, to be honest.
So I was going to ask, what do you hope people get when they read your book?
depressed. No. No, there's a couple of things I want them to do. I want them to, in general, evaluate who their allegiance is to in general. And it might not be a church, you know. I mean, there's probably someone who will pick up the book who's like, this has not been my experience with churches at all. You know, this church has been great. They've given me, you know, so much help and support and yada yada. What I want them to do is say, okay, but is there anything subtle going on that you're not talking about? Because the toxicity of churches really boils down to you can't be your authentic self. And that's a tragedy when you can't be your authentic self. So I would hope that someone reading this would go, something's been going on in my life that I can't talk about with these people. Why can't I talk about it with them? What's going on that's keeping me from talking about this subject with them, and is it the fact that they're controlling me, containing me, and asking me to convert other people to this religion, and that's their thing they care about most. Because if they care about that power structure more than you, you got to get out. It feels like I escaped. That is how it feels when I talk about Christianity. And most people won't talk about Christianity like that. But, you know, more and more people are okay with calling Mormonism a cult and certainly Scientology a cult. But for some reason, calling Christianity a cult seems taboo still. And I'm like, no, it doesn't have to be, but it certainly has become one. And since it's become one, we need to deal with it as such.
Okay. Now, do you have a website that people can send all their hate mail to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Little trade secret. If you're angry at me, comment on my post on Facebook. You can find me on Facebook, John Verner. The more engagements I get, the better for me. So feel free to just have at it. I love it. I think it's great. You can either check out my Facebook page, which is John Verner. I think it's facebook.com/howitbejohnev. I do have a website as well, vernerbooks.com. That's vernerbooks.com. And it'll link to all the info about me. And there's a link to send hate mail. So.
Oh, great. Fantastic. let's give us a little bit of a break, please.
Yeah.
Toward the attention of you. Mm-hmm. This has been great. Now, the book is called The Cult of Christianity, and the author is John Verner, and he's been our guest. Thank you for being on the show.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.